Welcome to Podcast with Lara Axtell. In each episode of Podcast, Lara explores a current educational topic to identify practical solutions to help improve the future of education. Podcast is brought to you by Reading Horizons, the creator of a data-driven literacy program for beginning readers, struggling readers, and English language learners of all ages. Visit readinghorizons.com to learn more. And now, Podcast with your host, Lara Axtell.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Podcast. I'm Lara Axtell, your host, and I have the opportunity to read a variety of articles, blogs, and books that cover so many areas of education. That's how I came across our guest on today's episode, Rand Miller. Mr. Miller had written an article on taking his school staff on a walk of their community to better understand and support their students. It turns out that Rand does a lot of writing and many other things, as you're about to hear. Today, Rand will share his insights on how educators can create classrooms that honor and nurture cultural inclusivity. Thanks so much for having this conversation with me, Rand.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm excited to talk to you today because I read an article that you had written, which led me to your website, Urban Education Mixtape, and your blogs are really compelling.
Thank you.
So could you start by telling us about your current roles in education? And I say roles because you do a lot of different things, writer, speaker. So explain a little bit about what you're involved in.
So I am currently a director of an after-school and summer program for a school district in New Jersey, where I help with programming and overseeing the instruction from teachers after school and during the summer. Previously, I was a social studies teacher. I taught high school and middle school for about 6 years. Currently, I also adjunct at a local university in teacher education program. And in my spare time, I try to write in a way to help teachers that work in urban schools. My website, my blog, the Urban Education Mixtape, is really geared and designed towards urban teachers that are working and need just a little bit of support with respect to certain things. I try to cover topics that administrators and other mentors don't really talk about. And I try to be honest and real with the teachers so that way they understand, we know what you're doing, we know what you're going through. And it's not just about books and assessments and those sort of things, but it's also about, what do you do when you push into a classroom? What happens when your administrator speaks to you in a way that is demeaning? Those sort of things. We talk about that as well. And the other thing that I write about, I also try to speak about issues in education, whether we're talking about the need to hire more teachers of color or for the need for teachers to be culturally competent or even matters of education policy. And I try to speak about that in my writing. And lastly, I also do professional development for teachers. A lot of my professional development surrounds the idea of cultural competency. And I've given a number of different presentations to schools and colleges and boards of education. And so I just try to keep busy with that and helping people and using that knowledge and information that I have to really help individuals be their best selves professionally and ultimately help the kids succeed.
So, Rand, I think you forgot one thing because you also write books.
Yes, this is true. This is true. I have written two books myself, one called The Cooper Street Offense, and it is a guide for urban teachers working with Black and Latinx students. Also, a book called The Double D's of Destruction, the idea of being distracted and being desensitized to certain things, having an effect on our communities. I've also been featured in a number of different books, writing chapters. Some of those books I can't think of off the top of my head. I know that one has to do with Black male teachers. I think it was called Diversifying the United States Teacher Workforce with Dr. Ivory Tolson. Another book, I believe it was called Principled Resistance. And that's a book about teachers who resisted some of the sort of non-teacher friendly type of activities put upon them by administrators. So I think that there's that. And I'm currently working on a book. It's more of a professional development book. It's where I'm taking some of what I talk about in my blog and using that to create professional development situations and activities for school district leaders and teachers to use as they go through the year in their professional development to improve their practice.
So today we're going to focus on just one of the things that you write and talk about, and that is creating culturally competent classrooms. So how do you define that? And why are you so passionate about this topic? And then what are the benefits of cultural competency in education? So break it down for us.
Okay, so what we mean when we say culturally competent, we specifically mean that we would like for teachers, administrators, educators to really be aware and responsive on a cultural level, talking about race, talking about ethnicity, primarily race and ethnicity, but not just limited to that. We're even talking about generational. We're talking about religious. We're talking about gender identification. We want for teachers to really understand, and administrators as well, the population of students that they're dealing with. One of the reasons why I'm so passionate about it is because growing up, most of my teachers, if not all of them, were white. And although I do believe I got a good education, I think that there were a number of things that were left out. And also, I don't feel like I always had a connection with my teachers. My teachers didn't always, know the type of individual that I was. I don't think that they even cared where I came from. I think that they thought that because you're in a classroom, this is how we are, this is what we need to do. I teach, you learn, and that's the relationship that we need to have. But in reality, we see that that's not really how we should go about teaching students, particularly students of color. We know that students of color benefit, particularly African-American students, they benefit from culturally responsive teaching and culturally competent classrooms. There's research that shows this. And so when students have the sort of culturally responsive and culturally competent instruction, they really can see themselves in the curriculum, they see themselves in the instruction, and they can actually see themselves succeed. For example, if I'm giving an assignment and I want the students to read something and I want them to write a paper on that assignment, I could give them something that they've never done before, right? If my students are, in a certain environment and say they don't have any knowledge of agriculture, right? They don't have any idea about that. I could give them a passage to write about that has to do with agriculture. They may not care to write about that. They certainly may not have the knowledge beforehand prior to really be able to speak to that. But if I were to give them a reading assignment about something that they are aware of, even if they're not necessarily the most interested in it, they have a cultural knowledge that they can bring to their writing in order for me to really ascertain whether or not they comprehended what they read. That's cultural competence. And we don't see a lot of that in education. I think that there are administrators that are looking to do that more, but it's not where we need it to be. And so I think if more teachers and more educators understood how cultural competence can help their students succeed, I think you'd see more of that being implemented in the classroom. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people think that the term and the meaning behind it is real gimmicky. And there's a lot of gimmicks going on in education, but I really wish that folks understood that, no, cultural competence is a real thing and it can have a real impact for the benefit of your students.
So let's talk a little bit more about those benefits, but connecting it to what you mentioned, your own school experiences. As a student, what did you need that could have made a difference? What would you have liked to have seen in the classroom?
That's a good question. I'll start with curriculum. I think the easiest thing for me, being a former history teacher, is to go there, right? So in my history classes growing up, history was interesting to a certain degree, but it wasn't necessarily the most interesting thing in the world because, you didn't really see, I didn't see myself as a young Black man. I didn't see myself. I didn't see a lot of my people in the history, other than the fact that, we were slaves. And that was kind of like we were slaves and then that was it. And we were freed and that was the end of it. And so everybody is back to being at this place of equality. And that's not truly the American story, right? If I grew up and we weren't, you know, I didn't grow up in a household that was destitute, if I could use that word. However, my parents were working parents. They were, you know, working class, they worked hard. And I didn't always understand why things were always the way that they were, why the struggle was the way that it was. As I got older and I got into college and I started reading certain books and introduced to different authors, I began to put the pieces together to see how the history of this country and how racism and racist policies went into play that actually created the conditions for the way certain people have to live in this country. In particular, African Americans. And so if I had been introduced to that sort of information, it really could have not just only changed my, you know, grade trajectory, but also it could have changed my career trajectory in terms of what it was that I wanted to do. Not that I'm upset with where I am. I think that where I am is exactly where I'm supposed to be. However, I don't know what could have impacted that. In literature classes, not being able to read or not being introduced to people like Toni Morrison, James Baldwin, Langston Hughes, you know, not that Mark Twain was horrible and you know, Charles Dickens was okay, but just not having being introduced to those sort of authors of color. That's one area, just curriculum in general. I also think that with regards to how the lessons were taught, one of the things that I always tried to do was teach lessons in a culturally relevant way that made sense for students, meeting them where they were. And that wasn't always the case in school for me. I wasn't always met where I was. It was always, this is how I taught it, and this is how I'm going to teach it. I taught this to students before you. I'm going to teach it to you this way. I'm going to teach it this way after you. And, you know, there's a level of stubbornness. I understand it may have worked, quote unquote, but I do believe that for a different population of students, things aren't always the same. You know, for African-American students, there's a lot of call and response techniques that work very well for us. That's not necessarily how I was taught growing up in school. It wasn't really call and response. It wasn't storytelling, anything like that. It was a lot of being lectured to. And there's research that shows that those sort of approaches don't always work best with students of color. So that's another way when we talk about just the instructional methods of teachers with students of color. And I think that it's really important for folks to understand this, considering our composition in our schools. The majority of students now, as of 2014, are students of color. And the majority of teachers in our country are white and female. And so this sort of information, I really believe, can help those teachers work with students that are changing in terms of the demographic scope of who's in our schools now. And I would probably say lastly, with regards to my experience, what I may have needed was I think that it would have been nice to have more teachers that looked like me in the classroom. Not to say that white teachers can't teach black students or any students of color, but the majority of my classrooms were white in terms of the teachers. I never got a chance to really see someone who looked like me until I got to college. And when I got to college and saw that, it completely changed the way I thought about, you know, why teaching is so important. And when I became a teacher, I looked back at those experiences in college where my professors, I had some black professors, and it was like, wow, these folks really introduced me to a way of thinking and different resources and readings that I never would have even imagined. And I'm like, why didn't I get this when I was in high school? Well, when you have teachers of color, they provide you with a different perspective. They provide you with different information. Not to say that white teachers don't have it, but it's just to say, and I would argue that a lot more so now than before, in my view, there are a lot of white teachers who get it, which is good compared to when I was in high school. But teachers of color, African-American teachers provide a different way of seeing, a different amount of resources for students of color to really pick up on and use. So if I would put it in a nutshell, I would definitely say just curriculum, instructional methods, and the teachers who are teaching in the classroom. I think that those three things, when you have a culturally competent school district, you see the cultural competence show in those three areas. Had I had those growing up, I think my educational experience would have been a lot different.
So can you explain a little bit? Call and response may be a term that teachers are not familiar with. Could you explain what that is?
Sure. So call and response, the idea of that is if, you know, I were to say one thing, you know, to a group, the group would talk back to me. So one of the best examples of that is in the Black church. There's a lot of call and response where if the preacher is up and he's saying something, and as he's saying something and you know, to get where the audience is, if they're following him, if they're understanding what they're saying, he's going to expect a certain response. So if the preacher's saying something that the congregation likes, the congregants will shout back, like they'll say amen or go ahead and preach or you're preaching now, pastor, that sort of thing. And it lets the pastor know that he's going in the right direction. And there's that sort of relationship to do that. If you hear in popular song, I remember the movie Ray, where Jamie Foxx is playing Ray Charles, and there's this part in the movie where he was about to get finished his set and the audience wanted more. And the person said, you have to stay on, the person in the club. And he's like, we won't have no more songs. And he said, well, you better figure something out. So Ray Charles made up a song. And in the song, he did call and response. He told the audience, he said, you know, and he didn't even say it. He was just like, And then the crowd went ahead and mimicked what he did. And there was that sort of transaction of, I'm doing this and you're going to be a part of this song. Just do what I say. And that call and response can be put in the classroom as well, where if a teacher is leading a lesson, we start to see where the teacher can bring the students in as part of the lesson. A good example of that is a teacher who maybe they're teaching kindergarten or first grade, and they may use song, they may use a poem, and they do that to teach, say, maybe they're teaching continents and capitals. Maybe they're teaching about the state capitals and countries and all that sort of thing, and then they use that in order to incorporate students within their lesson, within what's happening. It's basically a transaction where it's not just one person doing leading, it's actually the people who are being spoken to, they are participating in with the lesson or whatever it is that's going on. If I were teaching a unit on the civil rights movement and I really wanted to focus on a piece of a phrase or a chant, and I could incorporate this into a literature piece, right? One of the chants that you would hear in the 60s was, you know, no justice, no peace, no justice, no peace. And maybe I yell no justice to see if anybody even knows what comes after that. And then maybe a child says no peace. And then I say, okay. And I, you know, say no justice louder. And I expect for the group to say no peace. And then I get them riled up to the point where I'm yelling no justice. They're yelling no peace. And now they're sort of channeling a spirit of protest. And then I can go there and I can say, okay, what does that mean? And then I can turn that into a conversation where now we can explore what the phrase no justice, no peace means. And even if we get to a place where students are a little, you know, not sure what it exactly means, I can have them do it again and tell me what you feel when you say that. What do you feel when you say that phrase, no peace, when I'm yelling no justice, that back and forth, right? And that's an opportunity for me to not only just include them in the lesson, but it's an opportunity for me to allow students to feel something versus reading per se and me telling them what this meant. Now I'm giving them an opportunity to actually engage in the words, engage in that spirit of protest, for them to be able to articulate and internalize exactly what they feel and how that connects to what protesters actually felt. And then, of course, I can take that into protest today. We've seen various protests, you know, where it's whether it's March for Our Lives, whether it's Black Lives Matter. We can look at those and see what people mean and what people feel when they say phrases out loud and they do this call and response, and what that call and response can do. So that's a good example, I think, for older students, you know, how you would sort of gather what the protest means, how protest works, how language and call and response actually galvanizes a group and encourages and inspires them to push towards whatever goal they're pushing towards.
But at its real, really most basic level, it's about engagement, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You're getting kids engaged in the first place, and then it opens these other doors. And since we're talking about kind of basic things, what about like day one when a kid walks in the room, regardless of their grade level? What about the posters on the wall? What about the books on the teacher's bookshelf? Like, what are some basic kinds of things that teachers can do that, without even speaking, that communicate this classroom is culturally competent?
Well, one thing that they can do is, and I love your example with the books and the posters. When we think about our world and we think about whether it's history, science, math, English, any of the content areas that we look at, there are people that we go to, right? There are go-to folks that we would refer to for all kinds of things. And then there are people that we're not necessarily going to, we may or may not be aware of, right? So I think that it's important if we're going to put pictures up, if we're going to have books up, in addition to maybe having some voices that are constantly heard, we should really focus on having some voices that aren't heard. In light of what's going on in our country, we know that there's a voice or voices talking about immigration, right? We're hearing from people on one side saying immigration is good. It's, we should allow folks to come into our country. You're hearing another side that's saying, no, we shouldn't have immigrants coming to our country. We need to control the flow of people in our nation. We're not hearing from the immigrants themselves. We're not hearing from the folks who are risking their lives. And so maybe if you're a literature teacher, if you're going to do stuff this year, maybe you have a number of books written by folks who immigrated to this country. And I'm not just talking about folks coming from Europe. I'm talking about folks coming from Central America, Latin America. Maybe somebody made a trek through Mexico to the United States, or they came by boat from Cuba or Haiti or anything like that to the United States. Maybe you have books in there to talk about that. Maybe you have famous folks in science and in entertainment who were immigrants themselves. And you can begin to shift, and that's just one example, but you can use that to shift the way people begin to think. And that's not necessarily just for urban schools. That's for suburban, that's for rural schools as well, so that everybody can see, hey, not only do immigrants contribute to our society, but also there's a voice that they have, right, that we don't always honor when we are having discussions about them. We don't honor their voice about what we're discussing. So, you know, you want to think about who are the people who don't have their voice being heard, and how can we have their voices heard in this classroom? So I would advise any teacher on that first day, look to put up posters, look to put up phrases, look to have books that honor those voices, those marginalized voices in all areas, whether we're talking about people of color, whether we're talking about women, whether we're talking about the LGBTQ community, whether we're talking about non-Christians. We can put up voices in our classrooms that expose our students to all walks of life and to show that although we are different, we are one, but our differences make us so much more powerful because we bring something to the table that make us better people and a better community.
And that's so much easier now because, for example, in English class, literature class, history class, those kind of things, there's so many more resources like Ink Knows No Borders, the poems of the immigrant and refugee experience, or books mm-hmm. like Kids Like Me. You know, there are now resources that teachers can draw on that do that. And so that leads me to the next question. You mentioned that sometimes in your history classes, your social studies classes, the only thing you heard about as it related to African Americans was slavery. So give me your take on Black History Month.
I think Black History Month is important. I used to not think that it was as important due to the fact that, you know, when I heard Black History coming up, it was growing up, it was always the same sort of people, Martin Luther King, Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass. It was the same sort of information. And I always felt like, well, you know, we hear that on a regular basis. We can learn that throughout the year. But as I got older, I realized, no, you don't hear it on a regular basis, because I heard it in my household, but I didn't necessarily hear it on a regular basis in school. So it's important to really take time and use that month to highlight things that you may or may not highlight. The reality is that schools don't always do the best job at presenting everyone's history, whether it's we're talking Black history, Hispanic Heritage Month, Asian American Month. We don't always do the best job. And I do think that there is a place for schools to really inject different histories within their curricula, right? And they can put that in history curriculum. They can put that in literature classes, things of that nature. But I do think that to highlight Black History Month in this case for this question, I think it's really important. You can do a little bit more than general. Like, you can bring in folks from the community to speak to certain things. You can actually take time to do studies of your own community and look at Black history in your own community, in your own city, your own state. So I do think that it's absolutely vital for schools to honor Black History Month, to honor all histories during their particular month, for them to really take a critical look and to really explore those things that we don't always explore. I think during Black History Month, we can really do a deep dive into the history of the people that we always talk about that we don't always know what their contribution was, or we can talk about individuals that we don't always speak about, or concepts that we don't always speak about. For example, we don't speak about the Maroons that were in the United States. There were like 55 Maroon communities where African Americans escaped slavery and they worked with Native Americans, and they actually built communities to keep slave masters out throughout the South. We don't talk about things like that. And I think that Black History Month gives you an opportunity to, one, discuss those things that we don't talk about, but also come and figure out how we can inject more of that into the curriculum. I think that for those reasons, we really have to take Black History Month seriously and really take the opportunity to engage with the history and figure out how we can take more of that monthly engagement and turn that into a year-round engagement.
Right. So really what you're saying is, we need Black History Month because that may be the only opportunity we have, but really it needs to be expanded to just being part of every social studies and history curriculum.
Absolutely.
We'll be right back.
Podcast is sponsored by Reading Horizons, the creator of a data-driven literacy program for beginning readers, struggling readers, and English language learners of all ages. With data-informing software and teacher-led instruction, students receive targeted intervention that leads to rapid reading improvement. Visit readinghorizons.com/trial for 14 days of free access to our software.
So let me ask you about, you know, some nuts and bolts. We talked about some basic things, you know, posters and just communicating to students from the beginning. I see you, I hear you. What are some other things that teachers need to know about the diverse classrooms they're working with? If I'm a new teacher or a teacher that's been teaching for a while and I'm Caucasian, what do I need to know?
Well, you want to know your population. And one of the things that I've always encouraged is for teachers, if their districts don't do it, teachers to really do like a research study, if you will. Basically, find information out about your community. You don't have to go to the kids. You don't have to ask them any questions that make people think one thing or another. But you should actually research your community. One of the things that I did before I put this in an article, as you know, was work with my district when I was a vice principal to have teachers walk the community. And it really opened their eyes to see exactly where their students were walking and some of the things that they may have encountered or didn't encounter. And then they also realized, like, hey, I didn't think that this community was a regular community. And it actually is. Like, I thought one thing, but that's not necessarily true. And then I encourage those teachers to go another step and to actually go in the community, patronize, like sort of go in there and engage with the community. Maybe you shop somewhere, maybe you eat somewhere.
and engage with the folks there, and you get a flavor for the community where you're working. I always think that that's so important for teachers to do. The other thing that they should do, again, as part of this research, is to actually look at some data, look at the community that they're working in, look at some of the data that's available online. You know, Google and the internet is a powerful tool. You can find census level data that tells you about the community where you work, and you don't look at it with an eye for being sympathetic for people, but you look at it with an eye of empathy. So that way you're looking to empower and you're looking to advocate for. One other powerful thing that I would encourage any new teacher to do, go to a town hall meeting or go to, say, a city council meeting. Sort of see what's going on in the community that you're working with politically. Oftentimes we think that some communities are disengaged in the political process, that they're not really civically engaged. And you'll find that you'll hear from folks from the community you didn't even realize that, you know, you were, that there were people that could or would do that sort of engagement. It breaks down a lot of the stereotypes that teachers may have. The other byproduct of that is the more that you're seen in your community, you best believe that those parents will see you. You best believe that folks will know you in the community, and that gives you a different level of cachet, if you will. It gives you a different level of respect. Not only are you Mr. or Ms. So-and-so who works in my kid's school, but you're actually in my kid's community. You're actually in our community where we live. You're actually doing things that you're not required to do. You don't, no one told you you have to eat here, you have to purchase things here, or even attend our council meetings, but you do. So that must make me think you're invested on another level. I would implore all teachers to do their research. I would tell them to find out as much as they can about the community where they work. And again, not with a sympathetic eye, but an eye of empathy. And engage in possibly advocating on behalf of that community, on behalf of those students. Because if you're teaching those students and you're working with them and you really care about them, you don't just care about them with respect to getting the grade. You care about them as the whole child and what they're dealing with and sort of the community that they're cloaked under. And you want to make sure that you kind of get a foothold of that. I think that doing something like that could really change your perspective on teaching and really have you look at individuals and different communities in a way where it's not from a deficit model, but actually from a model of, hey, these folks have been impacted by structures that mean them harm, and we need to figure out how to attack these structures to make things better for this community.
So I know you're in a doctoral program and you work with the university to prepare teachers for training. In your opinion, is cultural competence a topic in schools of education? Are teachers receiving any information about working with culturally diverse populations?
Where I teach, I think that there's a concerted effort to bring cultural competence into the conversation. I know in classes that I teach, it's a huge part of what we do. I think that there are a lot of professors that want to do that kind of work. They may or may not know how to do that kind of work. And so I think that what we're seeing is that there are universities looking to really grow in that area, whether they hire folks that can do that work or they're training their folks to do it and work with students in that regard. So I do think that there is an acknowledging that this is important. I think that universities are trying to strategize on how to actually do it. And I think that that's better than where they've been. But I do think that I hope, let's put it that way, that these universities aren't spending too much time strategizing and worrying about how to do the work. And instead of that, they need to just get into doing the work.
So let's talk about the future a little bit. Where do we go from here? So what do you think needs to happen, really, to improve educational experiences for all children that will allow them to reach their full potential? So you mentioned just taking your school or some of your teachers on a walk of the neighborhood, or just going to eat even in a restaurant in the neighborhood where their kids live, like really simple things, what you have on your walls. You know, if this isn't like teachers don't have to feel like they're making some huge, you know, change in their teaching practices, right?
Right, right. So, yeah, I think that we often think that you have to do these monumental tasks in order to be better teachers and better administrators, and it doesn't have to be that. I think that engaging with people is what our job is, right? So when you're an educator in anything that you do, whether it's education or sales or you know, customer service, you're engaging with people. And engaging with people means being genuine and getting to know them. I know that there's a negative connotation when people refer to students and families as customers. But when we think about folks that are trying to provide a service to people, you have to get to know them. You have to get to know their needs. You have to get to know their wants, their dreams, their fears, their hopes. And I think that it's incumbent upon educators to do that very thing. I mean, we can assume that we know what families want. We can assume that we know what kids want, but it's different when we actually find out. And it's different when we find out in ways where we weren't necessarily looking to get the answers that we got, but we happened to go seeking after one thing and getting sort of something else that we actually needed. Maybe you invite folks from the community to come in and teach one of your classes, you know, you, of course, with the approval of your administration and you guiding that person, but maybe you bring them in and you have them give a talk to students and let students engage with someone from the community. These sort of things are things that you can do that you can do immediately. You don't have to go to the board to get approved. You can just do those sort of things and you can allow that to impact how you are in the classroom. And it really can and will change you. I think the other thing to the nuts and bolts of it, I do think that when you're in those conversations where you're talking about curriculum and you're talking about instruction and you're looking at these things and even assessment, teachers have to understand their power and their privilege. They have to understand that they are in these rooms that a lot of folks aren't in. Parents aren't in these classrooms and parents aren't in those decision-making rooms, right? These teachers have a say and they have a power and a privilege where they can really use their role to advocate on behalf of their students. If I could probably give one more thing, this might be a little bit more abstract, but I think that teachers really have to be honest, be transparent, be real with students, be authentic, and not just about who you are, but about the conditions of society, about how you can look at this theory in whatever class you're teaching and how that applies into the real life situations of your kids. We put the best interest of our kids at heart. It requires that we give a little bit more than what the curriculum asks for, right? To give a little bit more than what we're looking to assess and actually assess some things that aren't in the lesson plan or aren't a part of the standardized testing rubric. So we're looking to really pour life into kids that they can pour life into their communities and into our society.
So you're talking about some of the abstract benefits, but aren't there in reality some very concrete benefits, like when students are engaged in this way, better attendance, better graduation rates, you know, just there's research to support that, right?
Sure, absolutely. And when we realize and we know that students are engaged, we know that students are going to be prepared. They're going to be more likely to participate. They're going to be more likely to give more effort. And also some of the other things that are important too, when we talk about engaging students, we have to understand some of the things that we can do that may not even be attached to teaching and learning. For example, one of the things that I was good for was having fruit in my classroom, and maybe every other day. Now, I probably couldn't get it every day, but every other day I would have some bananas, I'd have some oranges, I'd have some apples in the classroom, and I would let the kids eat. If you've ever been in a classroom before lunchtime, kids are going nuts because they want to eat. They're hungry. Kids are growing. They always want to eat. So if you can provide them with some food, that helps your classroom tremendously because now it's like, okay, I'm eating, I'm putting good food in my system, and now I can engage. Even if the kids didn't have breakfast, they can come in and they can get that. If you've ever had a classroom after lunch or after recess,
right? Or, you know, after a time where they were not in class, it can be tough to get them back in order. So you want to sort of maybe have an activity. Maybe you do more activities in that class to keep them sort of not riled up, but keep their interest peaked, because they're not going to want to just sit down when they come into class. Maybe if you've ever had a class at the end of the day, this is the end of the day. Kids are ready to go home. You're ready to go home, right? And now you have to figure out how to keep these kids engaged at the very end of the day. So maybe you create some sort of procedure that gets them active at the end of the day in your lesson. So it's like understanding the time that you have students, understanding that certain things can motivate kids, and not just the gimmicky, hey, we'll play this game, I'll give you food. No, it's, you know, hey, I have fruit in here. If you're hungry, go ahead. That sort of thing, right? And we have to honor the feelings and the emotions and the place where students are. And when we do that, it helps us in the classroom as well. And there are tangible benefits to that also. When students know that you're understanding, when they know that you're a real person and that you understand that they're real people, they're more apt to work with you. Even when it's like, you know, the worst of times, you can get your classroom management back in order because they know, hey, Mr. or Miss so-and-so, they do this, they do that. They understand that, you know, things are the way they are sometimes. Let me cut them some slack. And that's how you can get your classroom management in order. That's how you can help with your teaching and your learning.
So that comes back to meeting kids where they are.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much. This is great information at a really important time. And I think it helps when teachers can really hear those specifics and know where to go next.
Oh, thank you. This was fun. I love talking about stuff like this, and I love being able to provide information for teachers to improve their practice. And I know particularly for new teachers, they're always overly concerned about what they can do and of the date. Have this theory right? Is their pedagogy right? Is this, that, and the third? And a lot of times it's just the keeping it simple is what you need to do.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this last episode of Season 3. I would like to thank Rand Miller and all of the guests who shared their time and expertise on so many educational topics. I'm already looking forward to Season 4. If you have not already subscribed to Podclast, you can do so to get notification of new episodes on iTunes or at www.readinghorizons.com, and look for the link at the bottom of the main page on the website. As always, thanks for sharing a part of your day with us.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Podclast. Visit readinghorizons.com/podcast to listen to past episodes and download free resources. If you enjoyed today's episode, leave us a review. Podclast is brought to you by Reading Horizons, the creator of a data-driven literacy program for beginning readers, struggling readers, and English language learners of all ages. With data-informing software and teacher-led instruction, students receive targeted intervention that leads to rapid reading improvement. Visit readinghorizons.com/demo to see if Reading Horizons is right for your school. Reading Horizons. Reading is for everyone.